Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and now we return to our panel discussion with a number of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists on the pervasive nature of fake news in our society today. If you haven't listened to the previous podcast, scroll down and find it, and then join us for this discussion. By the way, the panelists are Gina C., former senior editor of the Hartford Courant, Stephen G. Smith, photojournalist and University of Connecticut professor, Mike Stanton, former Providence Journal reporter and also a UConn professor, and Mike McIntyre, a New York Times reporter and NYU professor. We'll provide all of the information that you want about fake news, but you've got to listen to both. And the entire event was put on by Connecticut Humanities and involved both Capital Community College in Hartford as host site and Middlesex Community College, which taped the presentation. You won't want to miss this episode and the previous one on America Trends. And now we return to our panel discussion with a number of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists on the pervasive nature of fake news in our society today. If you haven't listened to the previous podcast, scroll down and find it, and then join us for this discussion. By the way, the panelists are Gina C., former senior editor of the Hartford Courant, Stephen G. Smith, photojournalist and University of Connecticut professor, Mike Stanton, former Providence Journal reporter and also a UConn professor, and Mike McIntyre, a New York Times reporter and NYU professor. We'll provide all of the information that you want about fake news, but you've got to listen to both. And the entire event was put on by Connecticut Humanities and involved both Capital Community College in Hartford as host site and Middlesex Community College, which taped the presentation. You won't want to miss this episode and the previous one on America Trends.
I'm really glad you brought that up because it was a kind of a dark day in, I think, journalism in this country in terms of the failures of mainstream media to properly vet, you know, this information that was coming out of Washington. The New York Times was guilty of that. I think this is an important point, though, especially as we're talking about fake news. The types of fake news that we're discussing here today, I think, are some of the obvious ones in which you've got sources.
But that was obvious. I was a teenager and I could see that evidence was manufactured. It made no sense.
I'm talking about the sources of the information being obvious. In other words, when we talk about Pizzagate or something like that, you look at where that's coming from and it's, you know, obviously not something that's very reliable, right? In the case of what you're talking about, the run-up to the Iraq War and the justification of it that appeared in these news stories, it was originating from sources of information that traditionally had been reliable, reviewed as reliable.
Curveball.
And so what ends up happening in that particular case, which I think is an important distinction to make in terms of who produced this news, the New York Times fell down on that, and they acknowledged it, and they did a humongous investigation of themselves and produced a very in-depth series of stories about how the New York Times screwed up.
After the war?
No, after the, you know, run-up to the war. I can't remember exactly when that came out, but when it became clear that this was, you know, something which was based on shaky information or not even information that existed. So there was some accountability there, which is something that I think is also a measure of what makes a reputable news organization. If you're trying to decide where you're going to get your information from, you're not going to get that from many of the sources that we're talking about here today.
Not.
So, I mean, you make an important point about what do we define as fake news versus an honest mistake. And you can argue about whether or not that's a momentous mistake. I think in this case, you have a pretty strong argument that probably was. But was it a mistake driven by malevolence? Was it a mistake driven by geopolitical strategic goals? Was it a mistake driven by partisan objectives? No, it was a journalistic failure, which the New York Times owned up to and took responsibility for.
Was it a mistake?
Was what a mistake?
Was it a mistake?
I'm
You mean the stories about Iraq having the
weapons? Yeah, I mean, this is a huge mistake to be on every TV channel, in every newspaper, in every magazine.
Right. Well,
if I could jump in, I don't think what Mike is saying is that it wasn't a mistake, but it wasn't a deliberately manufactured story by a reporter, you know, who knew it was wrong at the time.
Yeah, I think
but
that's
didn't take the necessary steps to verify it.
How are we supposed to spot fake news if you can't?
So that's, you know, a really, I think, a good, valid question. I think that you have to look at a news organization's reputation and record in its totality. And so the New York Times has had a share of ups and downs in terms of, you know, honest errors that were made. And, you know, when those things happen, they take accountability and responsibility for it. I would stack up our successes against any other news organization. In fact, the Times has won more Pulitzer Prizes than any other news organization in the world. So I'm not going to sit here and defend the integrity of the New York Times. I don't feel like there's a need to do that. But I understand the point of view of this gentleman here, and certainly there are a lot of people who, you know, have good reason to be upset with the performance of the media, not just the Times, in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Can we go back and perhaps parse that question in another way? How does journalism try to separate itself from official, generally reliable sources? When we look at a lot of the wars, not just the Iraq War, but you look at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which has been disproved now, many years later, as the premise for that conflict. You look at the Spanish-American War, you know, William Randolph Hearst, you bring me the army, I'll bring you the war. So, I mean, how do you, is Donald Trump doing us a service by looking at the press in such an adversarial way and the press responding saying, I now am going to look at everything that you're doing? Is that a good thing without bringing down the Fourth Estate as opposed to cozying up to those official sources? Why don't we just go down the line on this?
I'm going to step back and address the original question as well. I don't think we're perfect. I mean, and I don't think we claim to be. We try really hard to make the best draft of the first draft of history that we possibly can. We have an established set of ethics that really help guide us, and occasionally we screw up. And I think that the point was well taken, that was a case where potentially we screwed up, and it was a big cost to it. But we're certainly not perfect, and I recognize that. And I find this profession to be incredibly humbling, but I find it to be also very, very important.
Gina?
I would agree that just like anyone in any profession, no one's perfect, and you go in day to day, but you also have to realize that it's really is a calling, and it's an even bigger challenge for the reporters coming along now. You've got so many demands to get the story, to interview the people, to get the video, to get the photo, and to get it posted before your competitor. And you don't have the gatekeepers that used to be in the newsroom that could help make sure that everything was factual. So to the reporters coming up, it's going to be even more critical that you develop those critical thinking skills, that you have those sources, and those sources have other sources, but do realize that most journalists that are really serious from credible organizations are really dedicated to telling the truth, to get you the facts so that you can make the determination.
You know, journalism is often called the Fourth Estate, and I think when you look at the uproar over the White House Correspondents' Dinner the other night and Michelle Wolf's monologue, and a lot of the reaction I've seen from people within journalism and outside is that they're fed up with the White House Correspondents' Dinner. They think it should be abolished. It represents too much of the coziness that exists, access journalism. And I think that those are the kinds of mistakes that have led to a downfall in trust in the media as well as other public institutions. And I think that that has helped with, coupled with the rise of social media, has helped create really fertile ground for fake news and blurred, you know, the actual definition of fake news into a shorthand, anything I don't like. And that's had dangerous consequences, you know, not only for President Trump's war on the media here, but abroad. Malaysia just passed a law last week outlawing fake news, criminalizing reporters who report fake news. 21 reporters in other countries around the world went to prison last year after their more oppressive governments than our democracy jailed them for reporting fake news. So it is a danger. But there is a difference between reckless reporting, irresponsible reporting, mistakes, and outright, you know, fraud.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming harder, I think, too, because we're living now in what has been called sort of a post-fact era, where it used to be said that, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. Now everyone's entitled to both, their own opinion and their own facts. And it's made things quite difficult if you're in the business of trying to, you know, present facts to people. It's just, you know, added another layer of complexity and stress in terms of dealing with the institutions you have to deal with to get information, determine what's newsworthy, pass it on to people in an intelligent, contextual way, and have them believe it. Because you've got, you know, very loud voices telling certain segments of the population that it's fake or it's not believable. So yeah, it's a challenge, unlike one that we've faced in the past. But you know, I think that it's certainly something which should not be overstated either. You know, one of the things I think important point to make is it's sometimes easy to blame fake news for things that you may not be happy with. If it was the outcome of the election, you might be upset about the role of fake news. There's no real way to measure this, though, to determine, like, you know, whether it really matters all that much that some bogus story is sluicing around Facebook. So I think in addition to all of the cautionary words that you're hearing today, it's also important to kind of not overstated either and get too worked up about it, because it's not the end of the world.
Okay, come on up. As a postscript, we should all remember that we lost, I believe today, 9 journalists in Afghanistan. And these are journalists on the front line trying to get us the story. So there's a postscript to the war that seems to never end in the Middle East.
How you doing?
Hey.
I remember when earlier you guys said that later, when things kind of settle down, that news and facts will be more important and maybe taken more seriously than they are today. I don't know if I agree, because it's like we're kind of like consumers, right? And we like things that kind of, you know, work better. Like, we want our cars to run faster, see, you know, more miles and stuff like that. So we want our stuff to be more streamlined, almost like the news. That's not entirely honest, all right? So aren't you like fighting human nature at this point, like progression? Like, I mean, people want easy, quick stories in their quick, fast lives. I mean, giving them a detailed story, most people are gonna like kind of like go the easy route. You know, that's just human nature in a way. Are you like kind of like fighting a really hard uphill battle?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Attention spans are a lot shorter. That's one of the challenges.
But I think that there's a difference, though, between content and the form in which it's delivered. So it's possible to have both. I mean, you can have, you know, bite-sized stories, you know, on your iPhone, and it's legitimate news. It's not something that's just made up or bogus.
I think she was saying earlier that, you know, all these mainstream places have to compete.
Right.
Bot computers who are, like, putting out things that break next speed. So, I mean, it's that human nature thing. It's also like, you know, how many news sites were there? 5, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah, right. 7,500.
You know, these guys have to make money too. Or you're not going to be able to put on your stories.
I think it's going to be worth it. Could be. I mean, there's definitely a profit motive there that incentivizes a lot of. One story which stuck with me from the coverage of the 2016 campaign was when we were trying to figure out who runs some of these fake news websites. I'm not talking about Facebook, but like, you know, websites that were had weird domain names, but they were cranking out all sorts of, you know, garbage that people were passing around. You know, we looked into some of them and were able to figure out that some were based in Russia and in the former Soviet republics like Georgia. And so we went over there and tried to actually find some of the people who were running these websites that were cranking out pro-Trump, anti-Hillary stuff in the US. There was one website, actually a whole collection of them, run by a college student in Georgia, this former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And he told us very matter-of-factly how he got into it. He's making a lot of money off of it selling ads on his websites. He said he started out actually more hits on the negative Clinton stuff than the negative Trump stuff. And so he kind of gravitated to just that. But he was in it purely for a money-making venture. He was not like a tool of the Russian government. He was just an entrepreneur doing this out of his dormitory in Georgia, halfway across around the world. So, you know, is he a competitor of the Times? Or I don't know. But I mean, he's certainly somebody who's part of the mix that you can't ignore. So, yeah, I mean, it's so easy now for anybody to do something like that, sure, I tend to agree there's probably going to be more of that before we see less of it.
My name's Carter. I'm a journalism student as well. Does cultural, educational, or home state background in individuals today affect those to be Muslim?
I think there have been studies that showed that that more people who were inclined to support President Trump were inclined to consume fake news stories. On the other hand, I think there have been studies that we don't want to jump the gun that say they don't really know how much these fake news stories actually influence a voter's opinion or decision versus just reinforcing their already held beliefs. On the other hand, when we talked earlier about the fact that young people in this digital age are less able to distinguish, you know, facts from propaganda, that cuts across, I think, all ideological lines and backgrounds. A lot that needs to be studied about this.
Sounds like a great research project.
Hi, my name's Josh. I'm also a journalism student here at Capital. My question is, so when I go on, so I'm guilty. I don't read like newspapers. I don't go like watch news. I would say it's in my nature to read more has increased since I joined the class, but I usually get my stuff on Twitter and stuff like that. So Twitter is more like an open discussion, right? People they post videos, pictures, captions, news stories, fake things. And it feels like everyone's discussing their opinion on the matter, and then somehow their opinion turns into the truth, and people keep spreading that like an echo chamber. So how do you think that affects how younger generations are going to grow up and almost evolve the way news is told?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, Twitter, I think, has an unfortunate tendency to make all of us act like middle schoolers having a spitball fight in the cafeteria. You know, at its worst, but at its best, it does provide a way for you to have your own sort of personalized news feed. You know, depending on what you choose to include, you can very quickly pick up on stories and things you might otherwise not have had access to once upon a time. But I think that does tend to lead to balkanization of people's, you know, news sources, where they pick sources that they think will validate their own preconceived view of the world. And that's a problem. So, I mean, my recommendation is to use Twitter the way I do, which is to basically pick a lot of different sources of information. So it's a constant stream of stories coming from outlets that you know, maybe before Twitter I wouldn't even have had access to very easily, but now I can, you know, get a full range of ideas from. But I mean, it's tough. I mean, yeah, it's like young people today are used to consuming information in bite-sized bits.
And if they very quickly scroll through something like that and don't fully understand where it's coming from, I think that it's a serious problem. But what you do about it, what do you think?
Well, that's my follow-up question, is that I think there should be a requirement in education, maybe at the middle school level, probably more prevalent, and above, to have literacy classes, media literacy classes, and maybe even technological classes, like based on Twitter, like just apps, because that's going to become the future, I feel like.
There's a bill. Isn't there a Senate bill that was it just passed, or Connecticut, that has created an advisory council within the Department of Education to relating to internet safety, digital citizenship, and media literacy, trying to promote that kind of thing in schools? I thought it was.
Could be.
Maybe it was just.
There is a lot of effort like that, and I think today's panel is an illustration of that as well. I know the town library in Mansfield, near UConn's main campus, they've instituted a digital literacy program. That is one of the things that people are stressing. There was actually the RAND Corporation came out with a study earlier this year about the phenomenon of fake news, and they actually caught a clever title. They called it Truth Decay. And one of the four tenets of this problem they saw was a decline in civics education and media literacy. And so they've talked about we need to do more research into that area and beef that up. And I am seeing anecdotally different, around where I live, different high school teachers are, incorporating fake news into their curriculum.
I have an example, actually, for at least an idea for the college level. So at CCSU, they made us take, made the freshmen all go to like kind of a skit about like sexual harassment and domestic abuse and how to deal with it. Do you think it would be a good idea to have a skit about fake news, maybe?
I do.
Depending on that.
Yeah.
I think it would be a great way to deal with it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet.
Maybe we could try some improv right now.
Yeah.
Let me see how good we are. Yes, and by the way, the general public, we don't want to leave you out of this conversation. So if you came expressly to hear about this and to get your thoughts on the table, your questions answered, please come up as well.
Well, thank you for coming and sharing your time with us. I'm Kelson, ATM Modest. I'm actually an adjunct professor here, and I would say a lifelong student. And I've grappled with this question even before I came here. So a comment and a question. And the comment is, that's your question, actually. why are we so apt to want things fast and quick? And the question is, and a couple of you actually mentioned that in your responses, the fact that we are not spending enough time in our curriculum training students of all ages to be critical thinkers, I think is a problem that we're facing with this particular item of fake news. Because whether it be science or journalism, I think there's always been fake things out here. There will continue to be fake things. And if we create critical thinkers, they'll be able to sieve out what's real, what's valid, and what's not. And I think there's some things that should be fast. Given to the public, for example, if there's a tornado watch, I would want to know that it's a real item because I'm going to the basement. And if tornado watches became fake, yeah, I think the entire society would give up on the weather news, even though sometimes it's inaccurate. But if tornado watches were fake news, I think we'll stay outside rather than running to the basement for safety. So what I'm really trying to say is, why are we not spending more time teaching everyone how to be critical thinkers, as we do in science, and as you've learned in journalism? Because I don't think that's happening. And when your high schools are graduating from high school and they can't read a basic line graph, which are in the newspapers, which show up on the television screens, so these folks that we are picking up this information are looking at these graphs and a photograph or any type of visual image, and they can't even read through it. We're not spending enough time teaching folks in our society how to be critical thinkers.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the issues I'd read was that the whole trend in education today is we've fallen behind in math and science. We have to emphasize math and science more, STEM, that's where the jobs are. So there's been kind of a drift away from, you know, the more social studies courses. And now I think people are realizing those are important as well.
Yeah, I think that that's really a very good point. I mean, it's been said that there's sort of a larger decay in civics, the instruction of it, civic institutions in this country, which kind of has contributed to this balkanization of politics, where you've got, you know, this increased tribalism, where you know, the various sides kind of stick to themselves and only want sources of information to validate their points of view. And critical thinking skills, I think, is one way to combat that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great idea to try to, you know, start at a younger level.
Yeah, and it turns people off to who wants to get involved in politics or government or even vote when you see all this tribalism going on. Unless you're a member of the tribe, you're just kind of disgusted.
Hi, my name is Linda Cocciola, and I'm an instructor here at Capital Community College, but I'm also a former journalist. And I'm curious what the panel thinks about the demise of local journalism, and how has that fed into our willingness to take directly words from the president through Twitter as news, or to go to my mayor's webpage to find out what's going on in my community before I vote, and where the future of Mike McIntyre is going to cut their teeth.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because we were discussing earlier, I used to work at the Hartford Courant before I went to the New York Times, and before that, it was the Waterbury newspaper, and that's where you had worked as well. And when I was at the Hartford Courant, I was an editor, and I left in 2003. And I think at the time, shortly before I left there, I was talking to Gene about this earlier, you know, I think the newsroom staff counted about 400 people. And I'd be surprised if there's a quarter of that left today. And you just can't do the same kind of journalism with that fewer resources. I mean, when I was there, I ran an investigations unit, which has 6 full-time reporters on it. We were a Pulitzer finalist 1 year. And, you know, for a medium-sized regional newspaper, that was a pretty good place to be. Nowadays, you've got basically 2 extremes. You have the big players at the very top who are succeeding. And at the very local level, you might have some weeklies. Like in my town, I live in southwestern Connecticut, and there's a hometown weekly newspaper which seems to do okay. And you kind of can pick it up every week and find out what's going on with the local boards and government, that sort of thing. But in between there is a big shrinking, you know, wasteland of which used to be occupied by serious good newspapers, which are struggling today to provide people with information they need to keep lawmakers accountable and keep their institutions acting responsibly. So that's one of the sadder results of this digital revolution that we've seen, and it's one that there really is no easy answer to in terms of how to solve it. It's been a conundrum. It's been very painful to watch as well.
Yeah. Has anyone looked at the local patches and these hyper local sites? It's usually a 1 or 2 person operation. They're doing video, audio, blogs. Are those having any impact in local communities? I know in Fairfield County, there's a lot of activity in Darien and Wilton and those kinds of places. No?
Yeah, I mean, from the ones I've seen, they're really nothing that you would go to find serious news stories about, like, you know, what's happening with the state budget or what's happening with crime rates in the state, or, I mean, they might help you know, like, when the Christmas tree pickup is going to be, you know, after the holidays, but, and I'm serious, I mean, that's really what, and I know because I submitted information about that from my son's Boy Scout troop, the local patch in my town, but, I mean, you know, what you need are newspapers like the Waterbury Republican, the Connecticut Post, and the New Haven Register, and the Hartford Courant to be able to, in a really robust, vigorous way, keep people informed, and they just don't have the resources to do it like they used to.
The mid-sized markets have taken the biggest hit, and, you know, the
economics for it right now does not look particularly good, unfortunately. They've downsized tremendously, the vast majority of them. And so, you know, the in-depth reporting has taken potentially the biggest hit there.
Yeah, and a corollary to that is that there's a lot fewer reporters at state capitals around the country. And that's an important area that's being ignored.
Hi, my name is Bill. And one thing, I subscribe to The Current and The Wall Street Journal. I also send money every year to The Connecticut Mirror and The Vermont Digger. And both of those online sources are really, I think, very good. I don't know, but I'm curious your opinion on that. I also just wanted to mention, I think, the point about the declining historical and civics education is an underreported crisis. And the STEM thing that took off and everybody embraced it is, that's important too, of course, but it boggles my mind that we are supposed to be self-governing, but we're not even teaching our children the tools. And in college, liberal arts have been discredited. So if you have any influence, write more stories about that. But I'm curious your opinion about these online newspapers.
I mean, I think the ones that that don't have the legacy debt issues, you know, giant printing plants and facilities. I know the organization that I worked for, the Rocky Mountain News, had built a multi-million dollar printing facility just prior to the digital revolution. That wasn't a particularly great business decision at that time. That debt really hurt them, of course. So these organizations that don't have that debt and are not looking at that sort of distribution model that the traditional newspapers were, are in, I think, in a pretty good position to potentially succeed. And it's fun to see them really kind of dig in and begin to do some quality work.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've been looking at and I'm interested in. Is there, I always tell our students that you're going to help invent the future. That it's not all bleak and hopeless. There's still a lot of people, you know, we're talking about this hopelessness of fake news and can't this. A lot of people, young people, have a hunger for news. They want to know what's going on. When they see, you know, terrible things happening, they say it's more important than ever that we be engaged. And there's experiments going on around the country. You know, we have a former Statehouse reporter who started Connecticut News Junkie. And she runs Christine Stewart, she runs a pretty, you know, thriving operation covering the State House and state politics. In Hawaii, Pierre Omidar, the eBay founder, or one of the founders, you know, he started a really respected local news website called Honolulu Civil Beat that really does a good job covering Hawaii state issues. So I think there's a lot of experimentation going on, some more successfully than others. Trying to figure out how to make it pay, but there's, you know, some good stuff happening out there.
Yeah. In closing, with the need to protect anonymous sources and the process of news gathering rather arcane to some, they don't understand exactly what goes into it, what kinds of vetting is required, how many layers of editing. What can your profession, that of journalism, do to make things a little less opaque to readers and viewers, win back their trust as an antidote to some of this fake news? Is there more that the journalism community has to do to stand up and defend itself?
I think panels like this are a great place to start, but I think, yeah, there definitely needs to be more. And that'll be, I think, an exciting time to see how some of those things are resolved. I'm not sure if I have all the answers, though, but this is a great place to have that discussion and to open it up.
Gina?
It would just go back to, you know, asking the citizens to be better critical thinkers and to broaden their sources for news, and to believe that most of the journalists out there are hardworking and really want to get at the truth and are very particular about the sources that they contact.
Yeah, and I would go back to my opening point. You know, I think we just need to keep doing what we do it well, be clear about how we're going about it, and really, you know, advocate for ourselves and call out fake news. In other words, when people just try to discredit a legitimate story as fake news, say, no, that's not fake news. This is why it's legitimate, and just, you know, stand our ground.
Yeah, I agree. I think producing great content is just the best way to kind of speak to this and make our points, as well as push back against the growing tendency to just dismiss real news that you don't like as fake news. I think in many ways that is actually a little more concerning than the actual fake news, which I think is of kind of marginal impact. Well, there really is no way to kind of accurately measure, you know, how many people believe these false stories and what the results of that is. But I think, as we've said earlier, a much more insidious byproduct of this is the tendency amongst, in some quarters, to just sort of use the term fake news as almost like an epithet to wield against legitimate stories and legitimate journalists. And you don't have to look too far to see the dangers that legitimate journalists face, including what happened just today in Afghanistan, where a number of them were murdered in a terrorist attack just for doing their jobs. That's not going to happen to some idiot sitting in his basement cranking out fake news. I think that the mainstream media, so to speak, could do a better job of sort of defending itself or making its case. But I think that the strongest way to do that is just produce good stuff.
It's hard to deny great work. I mean, when you see stuff that's really right. Well done, great journalism. And as a whole, I found this profession to be very admirable. And the people that I've worked with historically, I've just some top-notch people that really care about society. And, in many ways, I found it to be a very honorable profession.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, I'd like to close the panel, and I want to thank the Connecticut Humanities, the Capital Community College, and all who came today, and of course our panelists. As we close the last session that we did with social studies teachers, talking about a book that many of you may want to go back and get called Amusing Ourselves to Death from 1985, Neil Postman, looking at the view of the world of Huxley versus Orwell, and who had it right. And I'll leave you with a quote from that book. Orwell's visions are much easier to recognize and to oppose than Huxley's. Everything in our background has prepared us to know and resist prison when the gates begin to close around us. But who is prepared to take arms against a sea of amusements? Something we all have to ask ourselves. It may take more work, and as our last president before our current president said, what is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, giving ourselves to this difficult task.